Lunar Science. Welcome to Lunar Science, the series in which we discuss the scientific investigation of the Moon and its environment in the Artemis era. The chronology and properties of the Moon are our topics in episode 35. First, to chronology. James Head is with the Department of Earth, Environmental and Planetary Sciences at Rhode Island's Brown University. In March of 2022, he spoke to members of the Indian Institute of Technology, which is in Kharagpur.
So let's step back and think about where we are right now, if you will. If we think about this, for example, it's been 50 years since the Apollo program. Hard for me to believe. It seems like yesterday to me. But in fact, it's been 50 years. Right now, 50 years ago, we were between the Apollo 16 and the Apollo 17 mission. And now, 50 years later, NASA and the United States and a number of other countries are going forward to the Moon and on to Mars together. So it's a very exciting time, very exciting time. I tell my students every year, you couldn't have come into a planetary science career at a better time. And sometimes I worry, well, gee, am I not telling the truth? No, it's always good. It gets better every year. So I encourage you all to think about these kinds of careers as well. And the strongest planetary scientist has the best Earth background. So let's step back and think a little bit about where we were before we went to the Moon with Apollo. Pre-1959, for example, what do we know about the Moon and what did we not know? Well, we didn't know its origin. We didn't know its age. We didn't know how it formed. We didn't know the nature of the surface, those dark areas, the Maria or the Terra, the bright areas, the heavily cratered areas. And we didn't know the age of the surface. We didn't even know the origin of craters. Were they volcanic or were they impact? This was hotly debated. Even more importantly, we didn't know what the other half of the Moon looked like. We had not seen the far side of the Moon. Just amazing. Think about that. Compare that to what we know now based on largely the Apollo program. Now, of course, at this time, there was a Cold War going on and the Soviet Union was doing some absolutely amazing planetary exploration, particularly with the Moon, sending landers, rovers, returning samples robotically, sending orbiters and sending human-rated missions as well. The engineers in the Soviet Union were just amazing, and they did really, really great things. And so that's one of the things to really think about, because, in fact, international endeavors and international cooperation and collaboration are critically important to the future. Of course, with the Cold War, between basically primarily the United States and the Soviet Union, there was a big issue about leadership. And so threatened, if you will, by the missile gap and by the Soviet successes on the Moon and in space, President John Kennedy in 1961 set the amazing goal to send human beings to the Moon and return them safely by the end of the decade. What? How are you going to do that? 1961. And I was a graduate student at this time at Brown University, and I was working on my PhD thesis, which was shallow marine carbonate environments in the early Devonian of the Appalachians. Had nothing to do with the Moon, nothing to do with space. But I was looking for a job and I saw this ad. It just had a picture of the Moon and it said, our job is to think our way to the Moon and back. If you're interested, call this number. How could you not be interested? How do you think your way to the Moon and back? So I called the number, it was NASA headquarters. I interviewed for the position and I actually got the job. I didn't know anything about the Moon. But nobody did. So basically, we had to think our way to the moon and back. So over my career, I was able to utilize early on working the Apollo program, absolutely incredible launch vehicle, sending three humans to the moon, a command and service module, which in fact is had the three astronauts in it, but also lots of instruments in here that could be used to look at the moon from orbit. And then, of course, the lunar module, which took the astronauts down to the surface so they explore the surface, and then an ascent version of this, which then came back up, rendezvoused, and brought them back to the Earth. This was an amazing capability. And my job from 1968 to 1973 was, what questions do we want to answer from the moon? Where do we go? Site selection. Where do we go to answer those questions? And then when we land, what do? When we get there? Okay. You know, you just don't say, okay, we're here. What do you do when you get there? Traverse planning. And also, how do we implement the science goals and objectives? That's where the science and engineering synergism comes in. And then, of course, just as with me, I knew nothing about the moon. I was learning very rapidly as we went along. But the astronauts also mostly were test pilots, and they had no formal geological training. So we had to train the astronauts. Believe me, they were extremely good students, extremely bright and motivated people, which made the job relatively easy, but it took a lot of time. Field trips all over the planet and lots of different training sessions. We also had to simulate going to the moon. We had to go to Houston and the absolute, you know, the mission operations when the actual missions were taking place. And then when the astronauts came back, we would debrief. How did it go? What did you do? What could we do to improve? And then we would put that into feed forward replanning of the subsequent missions, which could be happening in the next 3 or 4 months, maybe 6 months. So it was a very busy job, to put it mildly. I always like to say it was before frequent flyer miles. If there had been frequent flyer miles, I would have enough miles to go to Pluto and back, trust me. But there weren't, unfortunately, at that time. So what did we do? People think, oh, Apollo landed on the moon, brought humans back. It was much more than that. We had a four-pronged approach: surface science stations, surface exploration, orbital exploration, and then using the moon as a platform. Okay, we've got the moon. We're away from the atmosphere. We can look out into space and make observations that we can't make effectively on the Earth. There was a huge range of science at all levels during Apollo. This is kind of like a secret in a way. It shouldn't be, but it is not well known. People generally think that there was just one mission and, you know, we accomplished a national goal and then stayed home. Not the case at all. The other thing to realize is that there were precursor missions. Before Neil Armstrong put his foot down, the first step on the moon, there were 21 robotic precursor missions in 8 years. 21 missions in 8 years. These were all designed to understand what's going on and what was going on in terms of the soil, in terms of the orbiting, to give us information for site selection and beyond. So I want to run through the different Apollo missions to illustrate exactly what the science and engineering synergism was able to accomplish. This was really important. So I'll use this and come back to this template so you can see what happened as a function of time and how we were able to work with the engineers to increase the science capabilities. So Apollo 7, 8, 9, and 10 were precursor missions to test out the equipment, to try out the operations, et cetera. And they were all very successful. And then what I want to do is to go through each of these steps here very briefly and show you how at each step of the way we were able to increase the capabilities in exploration and return of science data. So first, of course, we wanted to land safely. That was critically important. We needed to deploy some experiments and then collect rocks and soil. And of course, Apollo 11 on July 16th, 1969 was launched with a target site in the Eastern Maria. And that was designed both because it was very smooth and ensured astronaut safety. And also it was really interesting to try to date those Maury deposits and figure out how they formed. So as is well known, on July 20th, 1969, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin landed on the moon. Neil was the first human to walk on the moon, followed quickly by Buzz Aldrin. They set up scientific experiments and they explored a wide range of areas around the lunar module and of course over to West Crater. And indeed, and the astronauts were very well trained. They did a lot of experiments on the surface. They had had geological training. They did a superb job, given the fact that it was the first mission to the moon. And they returned a total of essentially 21 kilograms, about 21 and a half kilograms of rocks and soils. They were out on the surface for only 2 hours and 30 minutes, but they were able to collect a great set of samples. And indeed, the white materials in the soil were what gave us the idea about the lunar magma ocean. John Wood looked at those soils and came up with that concept first. So we, even with Apollo 11, we learned a huge amount. But we wanted to increase the stay time on the lunar surface. A couple of hours was great, but we wanted to make it more than that. We wanted to increase the number of EVA periods. That's the time you go out onto the surface, to two, not just one. And also Apollo 11 landed about a few kilometers downrange because of the roughness of some of the crater ejecta. And we wanted to demonstrate that we could land pinpoint. We wanted to go to a specific point on the moon so we could go to difficult areas, rough areas, and land between the rough areas on smooth areas. And so on Apollo 12, that was designed to accomplish these three goals. So on 4 months later, after Apollo 11, Apollo 12 was launched to the moon, and the landing site was in the Western Maria. How much different are the Maria on the surface? These appeared to have fewer craters. Are they younger? How much younger? We needed radiometric dates from these. So the key here is that Alan Bean and Pete Conrad landed on the surface, and they were able to, in fact, land right next to the Surveyor 3 spacecraft. We targeted for the Surveyor 3 spacecraft. They landed right next to it, a beautiful example of pinpoint landing. And then they had traverses all the way around here to Middle Crescent Head, Bench Crater, Surveyor Crater. And they were very, very successful in analyzing the data, exploring different depths from crater ejecta, et cetera. And they had two EVAs, almost 8 hours of time on the surface, 3 kilometers walking around on the surface, and almost 34 and a half kilograms of rocks increasing the capability. And these rocks were pretty amazing. Not only were they younger, but they also demonstrated from material thrown in from outside some very unique kinds of things that we had not at all explored before. Of course, when the astronauts got back and when we debriefed Pete Conrad and Alan Bean, they said we could really use like a wheelbarrow, like a truck to pull along with us so we could put our tools and all our samples along there. We could do much more if we had that capability. So we worked with the engineers and they designed like a little wheelbarrow almost to transport the samples and the tools, etc. And on Apollo 14, after the accident on Apollo 13, 9 months after Apollo 13, the spacecraft was targeted to a very rough area in the Fra Mara formation, the ejecta from this giant basin here. And so the astronauts, essentially, Ed Mitchell and Alan Shepard landed in this very rough area. And indeed, they set up a series of scientific instruments and used this mobile equipment transporter to carry all the materials around. And then it was very effective in increasing their capabilities. You can see the tracks of the mobile equipment transporter, a MET, that going from the lunar module up into the mountains here, the ridges, and they actually had 9 hours on the surface, almost 9.5 hours, 3 or 4 kilometers just walking with a wheelbarrow, and almost 43 kilograms of soil and rocks. So that was really amazing. And indeed, the next key thing that they found potentially is a rock they found on Apollo 14, which recently people have thought may contain a felsite clast that was transported, blown off Earth early in its history. So we may actually have a piece of ancient Earth preserved on the moon from ejecta thrown off an impact on the Earth. So this is the kind of exciting discovery that who would have anticipated that? So the next thing we wanted to do was, in fact, increase the number of EVA periods, go to higher latitudes, and provide mobility to reach distant targets. We really needed to not just walk around on the surface, but hey, why don't we have a car? Let's design a car. We work with the engineers to do all these things. And on 6 months after Apollo 14, Hadley, the Apollo 15 mission was targeted to the Imbrium Basin Rim, right here in the edge of this massive impact basin here. And the mission, in order to be successful, the astronauts had to do a plane change of their orbit. So if you're in equatorial orbit and you ascend to the surface, you can, in fact, easily get to back to the lunar module. But if you change your plane, it's much harder to get back to the lunar module. So this is something that we have, we're able to do, the work together with the engineers and the astronauts. In addition, we needed to go down to an abnormally steep descent profile down to the surface. And if we take a look here, these are the mountains. They're huge mountains, 14,000 feet high. And this rill was 900 meters deep, and it required a much steeper lunar module descent path. And the astronauts got into the simulator, tried it out a couple, we can do that. So the mission was targeted to this very complex area here. And in fact, as you can see, this was the first scientific expedition to the moon. Basically, Commander Dave Scott, shown here, and Jim Irwin, the lunar module pilot, landed successfully. Look at these mountains in the background. They flew over those mountains, did a steep descent, and came down to the surface. And this, of course, was the car that they had tucked into this place in the lunar module and were able to pull out and open up and deploy. So this is pretty amazing. And you can see here as well that Apollo 15 Commander Dave Scott, he's sitting here waiting. You can see the traverse maps here, the geological traverse maps, waiting to go. He's waiting to go. Jim Irwin's taking a picture, and they really went around the surface. They had three EVAs. They went out 7 kilometers from the lunar module and a total traverse of over 30 kilometers, and they collected 77 kilograms of rocks and soils. This is just amazing. I mean, this was the first scientific expedition to the moon. And the kinds of things that they found were, in fact, really important. They found these discovered green volcanic beads, glass beads. You should listen to the transcripts and hear Dave Scott just excitedly. They're green glass. In 2011, about 40 years later, Alberta Saul, a geochemist in our labs at Brown, discovered water in these glass beads. This is a major discovery, not just at the time, but also 40 years later. These samples keep on giving. We also found the Genesis rock, which was really critical in understanding the crust of the moon. And of course, we were able to look at rock layering here. Very difficult to find on the moon, but study this. These are a series of lava flows. And then on the way back, Dave Scott was so excited about this that he stopped the lunar rover and he said, "Houston, I have a difficulty with my seatbelt." Houston was saying, "Oh, get back to the lunar module. You're running low on oxygen. Get back as soon as you can." Yes, roger that, Houston, roger that. And he said, "Wait, I'm having trouble with my seatbelt." And, "Oh, well, fix your seatbelt. We don't want you falling off." Dave got out of the lunar rover, went over, collected this rock with all the holes in it, because he knew that this represented gas in the molten rock that solidified, and collected it and came back and said, "Okay, Houston, the seatbelt is fixed now. And okay, get back to the lunar module." And we all as scientists now call that the unauthorized stop, the seatbelt basalt. Okay, so he really knew what the science was all about. And when Dave got back from the moon, he said, "You know, Jim, it was so exciting doing the geology that I didn't even know I had my space suit on." Now that's pretty remarkable. I think I'd be looking over my shoulder, making sure the Earth was still there, checking my oxygen. Dave was like, "I didn't even know I had my suit on. It was so much fun doing the geology." And of course, the next two were also very important scientific expeditions. 9 months later, after Apollo 15, we landed in the Highlands to look for volcanic rocks. And in fact, when we were able to do this, Commander John Young and Charlie Duke went down to the surface, and they were able, in fact, to discover that, hey, it wasn't volcanic rock. It was basin and crater ejecta. This was a fundamental change in our thinking, and they did a superb job there. So when we take a look at this landing site, okay, there were three EVAs. They traversed 27 kilometers and returned almost 100 kilograms of rocks. So the next thing, of course, was to send a geologist as a member of the surface crew. Indeed, 8 months later, on Apollo 17, December 7th, 1972, Serenitatis Basin, the dark mantling deposits were discovered. There were a whole series of things here that really changed our thinking about the moon, not young volcanism, but old volcanism. This is Gene Cernan, together with lunar module pilot geologist Jack Schmidt, landed on the surface and explored the surface in the lunar rover. Lots of different scientific experiments, access to huge boulders here that had rolled down the hill from these steep mountainsides, and indeed the orange glass, the orange pyroclastic glass that we thought might be very young, but turned out to be 3.7 billion years old. So this is very, very exciting. Huge block that rolled down, and you can see it's been broken in two. And Jack Schmidt did a superb job of, in fact, describing this and sampling it. So three EVAs, almost 35 kilometers, and return 111 kilograms of rocks and soils. So this is amazing. Three scientific expeditions to the moon, to be sure, building on the results of the earlier missions. And the important point is that it was the engineering and science synergism that enabled us to get more mobility, more stay time on the moon, a car on the moon to drive around, and increase the capability as a function of time. But that wasn't all. The Apollo program was, in fact, canceled after these missions because of the Vietnam War and other demands on the budget. But we had plans to send a rover vehicle to the next landing site. So the idea was, okay, on Apollo 19, 20, and 21, we're actually going to take the lunar rover, add a cart to the back of it, and remotely power it from the Earth to go from that landing site to the next landing site, which could be hundreds of kilometers away, to interpolate between the landing sites. So lots of really good evidence for science and engineering synergism. So I think you can see from this successive landing safely on Apollo 11 to, in fact, a major scientific set of expeditions to the moon in the latter part, how science and engineering synergism really works. So you can see here the evolution of exploration scientific return. So looking at the Apollo missions as a function of distance, the walking missions were like less than 5 kilometers. And with a rover, we were out to in excess of 30 kilometers. And the same for the return sample mass. For the Apollo 11, 12, and 14 missions, less than 40 kilograms. On the other hand, over 100 kilograms by the time Apollo 17. So you can see science and engineering synergism is really critical.
That was Apollo-era geologist James Head sharing his experience with Indian students. Also at Brown University is Carly Pieters, where she is Professor of Geological Science. In August of 2021, she gave this talk about the moon's properties and its geology.
These are the general topics that I'd like to spend time on. The first half, I'll really talk about, in a very condensed form, some of the geology implications of the lunar evolution, just the basics about impacts and craters, and of course the regolith. Then the second half, if I still have time, I'd like to talk about some special areas that are different from most of the things that we've studied thus far with Apollo, but clearly are going to be important in the future. The far side of the moon has similarities to the near side, of course, but you can see very clearly a lot of its history clearly demonstrated. There are dark areas, there are bright areas, there's clearly impact craters. And the moon, if you look at topography, is covered by impact craters. It's exposed for more than 4 billion years, and it retains the evidence of that interaction. South Pole Aiken Basin is the largest documented basin on the moon and covers an extensive area on the far side of the moon. Looking at the near side and far side together, the near side, of course, is what you're familiar with when you look at the moon any night, and you see the dark areas that form a man in the moon, or a lady, a rabbit, what have you. And those are the basaltic terrains that are very similar in basic properties to basalts on the Earth, but were derived from the interiors. The bright areas, however, is the original crust of the moon. It's older than the basalts. The basalts came a couple hundred million years later, and it documents the primary crust that formed on the moon prior to the rest of its geologic evolution. The low albedo of the basaltic terrain is because it has a lot of iron and magnesium-rich minerals in it, whereas for the brighter highland crust, the feldspathic crust, has a lot of calcium and aluminum minerals, and that makes them brighter. Now, the brightest part you can see is associated with some of these craters. That's because these craters with these ray systems are younger than the rest of the terrain. Gradually, with time, those will be subdued with the weathering of the surface in the lunar environment. Okay, here's a overview of lunar geologic history in one slide. Let me walk through a few of the items that have been mentioned along the, it's a timeline essentially from the beginning to where we are now. The dashed line at the top separates two principal eras, the pre-Nectaran and everything after it. The first 500 million years of lunar history had a lot happening. It had this melting of the outer surface by whatever reason that gradually crystallized, forming the primordial feldspathic crust, rich with the aluminum calcium minerals, and the mantle, which is a lower and contains many of the iron and magnesium rich minerals. As the crust formed and became solid, with time, the mantle itself, with radiogenic decay, heated up, and you had an extrusion of basaltic material. That's sort of the dividing line at about 3.8 billion years, where basaltic volcanism began on the surface of the moon, spread across both the near side and less so on the far side with basaltic materials. So the basalts are smoother, they are younger by a couple hundred million years, but nevertheless have regolith that has been formed on them. Now, as was mentioned, on the moon, there's no rain, there is no atmosphere, there is no wind. The only thing that the moon does have a lot of are impacts, a continual rain. Fortunately, the size of the impactor has decreased, and we have infrequent larger ones, but very frequent small micrometeorite impacts. But of course, we have radiation, both solar radiation and galactic radiation, because there is no atmosphere. And these two proponents make the moon's surface what it is that we see today. The moon is covered with fine-grained regolith. As you've seen from the previous talks, there are rocks, there are boulders larger than Jack. but essentially, the regolith is everywhere, not only in boot prints, but you can see the tracks across the surface made within the regolith and is preserved today with the current sensors. Now, as I've alluded, there is weathering on the surface. How do you go from rocks to these intricate regolith components? Well, summarized here is all the various processes that are complex. They act at different times, but because the moon has been exposed for such an extended period of time, it accumulates and has a uniform, well, relatively uniform sequence, both on the Mare as well as the Hyland surfaces. Essentially, there's space weathering everywhere, but because of latitudinal differences, radiation differences, you do have some variation in the ultimate accumulation. Now, my specialty is spectroscopy, looking at how light reflects from the surface, and I look at it as a function of wavelength. And I have two examples here of samples measured in the laboratory from the visible part of the spectrum to the longer wavelengths, and how bright they are. And this shows you the principal effect of this weathering process, say for the Apollo 17 samples. Shown here is a basaltic sample in blue. It has these two beautiful absorption features that are due to the mineral pyroxene within the rocks, but it has no weathering. Similarly, a mature soil from the basaltic terrain has much lower albedo in the visible, and these absorptions are very subdued because of the weathering products. If we look at the surface with remotely, such as the M-Cube instrument, we see the same effects. So we know that the samples have documented the kind of effects that we see throughout the surface of the moon. Weathered products have weaker diagnostic absorption bands. They become darker across the visible, and they develop this overall slope to the continuum to longer wavelengths. Quite consistent everywhere we've looked thus far.
From Brown University, that was Carly Pieters, bringing to a close this 35th episode of Lunar Science.